I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest sociologist, Danielle Lindemann, is a big fan of reality TV shows. Her love affair started when she was a teenager and began watching The Real World on MTV when it was set in London. Here's the opening of the first season of the series, which debuted in 1992.
I thought it was like, this is never going to happen. This is not going to happen. They can't do this to seven people. At first, I thought that they were going to put us in, like, this little box, and it was going to be, like, a nightmare.
This is the true story. True story.
Seven strangers picked to live in a loft.
And have their lives taped.
To find out what happens.
What? When people stop being polite. Could you get the phone?
And start getting real.
The real world.
Danielle then got hooked on America's Next Top Model, The Real Housewives of Orange County, The Hills, Meet the Barkers. She obsessed with her friends over the characters, the conflicts, the plot lines, the drama, which she writes in her new book, True Story, helped her through some tough times. These shows are hugely popular, even though many people don't admit to watching them, dismissing them as lowbrow and trashy, which they often are. Danielle says you can also tell they can tell us a lot about ourselves and our culture. She writes that The Apprentice helped Donald Trump win the White House using the tropes and conventions of reality TV to appeal to his supporters. Well, we've got a lot more clips and a lot of things to talk about. Danielle Lindemann joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, and she's Associate Professor of Sociology at Lehigh University. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. So how did these reality TV shows help you through some tough times, as you write in your book?
I think there's something about watching reality TV that's kind of like an anesthetic in some ways. You know, especially if you maybe have a job like mine that's a little bit more kind of cerebral, just to be able to sit down and let the content wash over you. And it's kind of low stakes, right? There's so many high stakes things happening in the world, but you can just sit down and watch Real Housewives. And the highest stake is whether Ramona's inviting Luann to her party or not, right? And there's a relief to be found in that.
Ted Koppel famously said about reality TV that it was kind of a sign of the end of civilization. But reading your book, you say, no, it is civilization, that in a sense, this is who we are. Maybe, yes, it's through this fractured funhouse mirror, but it does reflect who we are.
Sure, it shows us an augmented form, you know, and again, some of the worst aspects of ourselves, our racism, our sexism, our classism, our various social inequalities. But I think it's important not to look away from reality TV, even if you don't like, you don't have to like it. You can find it trashy, but that doesn't mean that it can't tell us something important about ourselves.
Listening to that clip from The Real World, and we're going to play some other clips that are, you know, just so much more high octane, so much more conflict. I mean, would you say that these shows are really driven by conflict and competition?
Oh, absolutely.
The current ones.
But even in the past, right? Even in that clip you played from the first Real World, right? The producers kind of brought together people who were these different archetypes with the express purpose of driving that conflict. When you bring together seven strangers from different areas who've been raised differently from different socio-demographics, conflict is going to ignite. And so that's always kind of been the hallmark of reality TV, just more so now.
Just more so now. But again, when you were a younger person, and as you said, going through some tough times, is it that you said to yourself, well, at least I'm not living like that, or that there was something you could learn from these conflicts, how they got argued, maybe even how they got resolved?
Oh, for me personally, I think, you know, it was kind of a mix of things. One is, of course, the social distancing. Oh, at least I'm not like those people over there, right?
Right.
Which is more broadly is a reason that people tune in to reality TV. But I think also, you know, as a young person watching The Real World, it was kind of aspirational for me because you had these very, like, attractive, artistic, magnetic people that you were really drawn to on these shows.
And when you look at them, and I do want to play a couple of clips from the Real Housewives franchise.
Yes.
What are the sort of themes and even sort of characters or even caricatures that you see, you know, from one city to another or from one state to another?
Well, there's certainly the villain, right? And who that is maybe depends on the season. It kind of rotates, right? Who's on the villain couch in Andy's wrap-ups at the end of each season.
Right. Andy Cohen.
Andy Cohen, right. So there's the villain. There's the person who likes to stir things up among the other cast members, which is a hallmark not only of these shows, but also of real life. You know, sociologists have long pointed out that, you know, we have these small groups. We experience life in these small groups. And oftentimes there's a person there who's kind of trying to stir up conflict between others to their own advantage. So you certainly see that on The Real Housewives as well. And then oftentimes there's like the Greek chorus character who we're all supposed to kind of relate to. And Bethany served that role in Real Housewives for a while. In New York, right. And reminds us of ourselves.
It's so interesting to to think of all these sort of caricatures that get played out. And let me play a scene from The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and this is Teresa Giudice. Mm-hmm. Even she pronounces her last name differently
ways in Italian,
nonetheless,
in different contexts.
That's much more revealing than I probably need to do. But anyway, she gets into an argument with Danielle and flips the table in the middle
it's
of dinner.
It's always the Danielle.
There's always the Danielle. Food goes flying, and Teresa is screaming at Danielle. Let's give it a listen.
Two things are written that are true.
What?
Name change, I got arrested. Pay attention, please.
That was totally uncalled for what she did. Like, to pay attention, like, who is she? Is she God? No. So don't ever tell me to pay attention.
I am paying attention. Obviously, there has to be something else. It's just not name change and arresting. There has to be something else.
I was arrested.
Prostitution whore? You are f***ing gay 19 times? Who the f*** are you, bitch? Coming to my trap! You
And there goes the table, right? I mean, right. This became this, I don't know, was it a meme? It became this famous incident.
Iconic table.
Iconic,
flip.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How come?
I don't know. I mean, I think people were just really entertained by it. And this was the first season of Real Housewives of New Jersey. So this was a while ago. One of the things I think is really compelling about Teresa as a character, and you see it here, is that at this point in reality TV, a lot of people are just kind of going on these shows to play the game, right? They know what characters they're going to be when they go on. It's not very naturalistic like maybe it was in the early days. But something about Teresa is that she really reacts to things at a visceral level. So even if she is performing at times, there's kind of this sense that she is really, what you're seeing is really the real Teresa.
Well, it's interesting to talk about reality TV or even The Real Housewives when it does feel that there's very little that's real. And I'm sure that mm-hmm. the producers behind the scenes are, you know, are creating these characters and sort of pushing the plot line so that there is some kind of conflict. Every season, someone has a different nose than they are. All
nose,
of a sudden, the cheekbones are even more pronounced than they were the season before. The hair extensions get longer. I mean, what is real about The Real Housewives, do you think?
Right. I mean, that is true. You know, this is a critique about of reality TV that I often, you know, people even email me and say, you know, how can you write up these shows? Nothing's real here. Well, yeah, obviously, you know, it's not 100% real. For sure, you know, people are cast for the shows very deliberately. These shows are edited. They're curated. They're Frankenbitten together to create narratives. Absolutely, it's not 100% real. But, you know, nothing that's kind of created into a cultural product by human hands is 100% real. Even the news, you know, they're picking, and I'm not even talking about fake news, right? Just regular news. They're picking what stories to tell, and they're picking how to tell them. So, of course, it's not really real, but that doesn't mean that people like Teresa Giudice can't teach us more about who we are as a culture.
Has she taught you something about yourself?
Well, I don't know if I'd ever go to the extent of table flipping, but I do think that the relationships on The Real Housewives teach us about maybe who we are more, maybe not as individuals, but kind of more broadly on a social level.
Because of these sort of characters that we play, you mean?
Well, because of the characters that we play, but they also teach us about how we think about, say, wealth and social class, and how we feel that there's a certain, as Pierre Bourdieu, a sociologist, would say, habitus associated with social class. If you're a certain social class, you're expected to behave a certain way, and it seems out of place if you're not behaving in that certain way. That's maybe part of the appeal of The Real Housewives, is that they're ostensibly moneyed, even though we know, if we do some research, we know maybe they're not, right? But they're ostensibly moneyed, but they don't behave in ways that we think should match up with that, which teach us something about how we view social class as not just this economic category, but this kind of cultural category with certain expectations as well.
And they're not housewives. I mean, housewife is such an old-fashioned word in a way, isn't it?
It is. Well, right, but a lot of reality TV is kind of old-fashioned. It kind of thrives on kind of taking us back to these really kind of conservative values about how we think about families and gender and social class and things like that.
Well, let me play another scene, and this is from The Housewives of Atlanta Season 2. Cherie Whitfield argues with an events planner who has overpromised. Let's give it a quick listen.
Anthony is super incompetent.
Where's Keisha?
Keisha doesn't work. This is my event. You deal with me or you deal with no one.
How about I don't want to deal with you?
Okay, then you need to take your event and your attitude and be checked outside.
Will.
You don't need a reality check.
No, you need a reality
okay?
check.
Okay.
You don't have the connections, honey. It's Keisha.
Are you crazy? Google me and do my resume.
You need to get your face out of my face.
You need to watch yourself before you get checked.
Who gonna check me, boo? I have.
Anyway.
Are you okay?
No.
All of a sudden, things just went haywire.
First of all, your name is burnt in the industry.
My name is burnt in the industry.
And on and on and on it goes. Who gonna check me, boo? Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of line that lives on from that.
Right. I think Sheree was selling T-shirts that said, who gonna check me, boo, for a while.
Right. And there's always a party planner.
There is always a party
planner. I mean,
planner.
What is, you know, they hire people to organize a party.
Absolutely. So much interesting happening in that clip, though.
What?
Just in terms of, sort of archetypes that we talked about, right? This sort of angry black woman stereotype that has existed in American culture for hundreds of years, going back to, say, minstrelsy, and now kind of pools in the well of reality TV. Interestingly, often applied to women who are, again, ostensibly moneyed. Again, going back, you know, hundreds of years, there's kind of been this cultural impulse to, especially if black women are succeeding, to kind of strike them down, right? To sort of display them with these grotesque stereotypes. And so, yeah, I think that clip tells us a lot, not only about kind of gender, but also race and the intersection of the two.
But are you saying that they're playing these, as you say, grotesque stereotypes?
I think the producers are manufacturing, right? Because if you actually watch that episode, it's really interesting because Sheree is very calm and measured for a very long time. Like, I think it's 9 minutes or something. I measured it at one point. And then suddenly it just switches. And I don't know. I don't know if producers took her. I don't know. I can only speculate what happened in that moment. But it seemed like the show got what they wanted out of her. And I do think, yes, I think some people do play into those stereotypes purposefully and kind of are laughing all the way to the bank. But I think also the show portrays people of color and specifically black women in certain ways that kind of fall into these archetypes that are very comfortable for a lot of viewers in this rather racist way.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's our guest, Danielle Lindemann. We're talking about her new book. It's called True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you whether you like these shows or not. You've had a little bit of a taste of what they sound like on the radio. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Danielle Linneman. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at Lehigh University. She's written a couple of books, and she's got a new one we're talking about. It's called True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. You can join us by giving us a call, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Broadly speaking, and we've been listening to some clips from The Real Housewives, it is interesting to see how people of color either are portrayed or have these sort of more minor roles in a lot of these these TV shows, sort of an accidental character, or the the one black friend that someone has on a show that's of white women, let's say one of the Real Housewives. How do you see race then playing out in these shows?
Sure, yeah, in different ways, right? So on shows like The Bachelor, or historically The Bachelor, or Real Housewives, it's oftentimes these people of color who kind of just serve to kind of facilitate the narratives of the white people who are perceived to be kind of the main protagonists of the show, right? Again, reflecting how people of color have been sidelined and marginalized more generally, more broadly, you know, in culture and in society. You know, if you also kind of look at reality TV shows, there are many kind of predominantly white shows have all or predominantly white people on them. But there are also shows that have predominantly people of color on them. You know, as I say in the book, that really reflects, you know, how broadly our culture is stratified kind of more generally by race, you know, in terms of where we go to school, in terms of where we live, in terms of who we date and who we marry and who we're friends with. So, you know, we can look at the shows and say maybe they have the moral imperative to diversify. That's a different question.
Sure.
But in some ways, they're just kind of reflecting society how it is, which is incredibly racist and incredibly stratified.
So these are what these shows are. If you look a little deeper or pay more attention, that's what they're telling us.
That is what they're telling us about ourselves, yeah.
Let me play one more clip from the Real Housewives franchise. And this is 2014 Real Housewives of New York City. Kristen splashed Ramona Singer with water at a lake. Ramona threw a glass at Kristen. Here Ramona is apologizing, sort of. Let's give it a listen.
I'm sick of it. Ramona flies off the handle and whips a glass at Kristen's face. Who does that?
So I reacted to what you did. I just reacted instinctually, and I never was intending to hurt you. So I'm really sorry.
This is an apology?
Sort of, I guess, yeah. I reacted. You threw water on me.
Sort
I didn't want
to. Sort of, you guess it's an apology?
You
Ramona?
Threw something at me.
And what did I throw at you?
Water. I threw water at you.
Yeah, a lot of
your
water.
Your hair looks fine. You hurled water at me. I hurled what I had in my hand. I'm sorry you got hurt. That's all I'm going to say. Bye.
And on and on and on it goes. And having watched probably more of The Real Housewives than I even intended to, it is a lot about you owe me an apology. I mean, you know, some infraction can go on for season upon season upon season about something that someone did to someone, and they want them to apologize. As a sociologist, what do you make of that?
And it's increasingly inconsequential things, too,
exactly.
Right? Like, you had an exclamation point in that text instead of a question mark, right. And then, like, three seasons later, they're still discussing it. Right. Well, I mean, I think it says something about sort of how the form of reality TV has changed, for one thing. You know, again, as we talked about, people are kind of going on the show now, kind of knowing what to expect, knowing what the narrative is supposed to be, even having some conception of what role they're supposed to play on the shows. So in that sense, it's a little less quote-unquote real than it was in kind of the heyday of the original Real World. And this sort of apology tour is part of that. They kind of understand someone's going to offend someone in the season over some sort of slight, and then there's going to need to be that apology so they can put it behind them and move on.
I mean, there is a question about why someone would go on a show like that, but if you watch them, they're often selling something. I mean, that they're using that to sell products or to promote, you know, some kind of spa that they went to.
Right. I mean, it's now this pipeline to kind of influencer culture, right, on social media, where now it's, you know, they're going on because you have, you know, your skincare line that you're going to hawk. And in your first season, you're going to say, this is my skincare line, and it's going to product placement. But, you know, I think that's sort of always been connected to reality TV. There's always been this kind of multi-platform approach where you're not only just watching the show, but also kind of being sold things. Even going back to the original Real World, where you're watching the show, but you're also hearing the music. And then it says at the bottom of the screen what music you're hearing. You know, or the Kardashians, where you're not just watching, but you're also, you know, buying the Kim doll. You're playing the Kim video game. You're following them on social media. So it's always kind of worked on more than one platform. It's just more so now.
Here's a comment from Sabrina. Do you think these shows are harmful because they portray these stereotypes of people, and viewers will think that every Italian-American or African-American behaves that way?
Yeah.
Which is an essential question.
It is.
Is this good for us or bad for us or what?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. These shows certainly are harmful in some ways. And I always say, you know, I do say I am a big fan of reality TV, but that doesn't mean that I can't be critical of reality TV. I'm deeply critical of it in many ways. I do think it's harmful. There are, you know, it's hard to tease out correlation and causation, but there are studies that show that reality TV has impacted us in kind of negative ways. There was one study that showed that watching The Biggest Loser causes people to be more fat phobic than people who watch, just say, a nature show. So there are studies that show that these shows can be harmful to us, and certainly in the way that they portray elements of race and gender and class and sexuality, I think they absolutely can be harmful. But I do think they can also be helpful in some ways. They really hold the potential to be helpful because they are watched by so many people. And there are certain examples of moments where reality TV, you know, I would say was beneficial. Like the show 16.
Well, give us one.
The show 16 and Pregnant, there was these economists did an analysis and they found there's actually a causal link between watching those shows and reduced teen pregnancy rates. So most people would say, you know, that's a beneficial outcome. There are people on these shows. These shows have been historically quite diverse and yet much more diverse than scripted TV and other forms of media. And yes, that takes the form of stereotypes often, which is negative. But there's something to be said for representation. If you think about someone like Pedro Zamora on one of the original Real World seasons, he was kind of first gay person, the first man living with AIDS that a lot of us kind of got to know as a person. So it's kind of taking us places where we might not go or experience otherwise were it not for reality TV. So I wouldn't be such a fan if I didn't believe in the potential of the genre.
No, I hear you. In fact, let me set up. I'm going to say this to our engineer. Al, we're going to do number 8. Thank you. We're like doing hand signals here. And this, I think, speaks to what you were just talking about. This is the first season of Bravo's RuPaul's Drag Race. Contestant Angina broke down in tears after learning she won the challenge and then reveals that she's HIV positive. Let's give this a listen.
Another impressive week. The judges love your style. And your screen test was very Viva Glam.
Thank you.
Angina? You're the winner of this challenge.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations, girl. I just wanted to say, and I've been always so afraid to say it, that I've been living with HIV for the last 2 years of my life, and this means so much to me. I didn't want to say it on national TV because my parents doesn't know. Oh my God.
I mean, that's a real moment. Those are very intense. Those are real tears. And I mean, what he's revealing this thing that he has kept so secret for probably his whole life, and here he is on TV, and his parents are watching.
Disclosing, yeah.
He's disclosing. I mean, that's powerful. You write about RuPaul's Drag Race, that there's a lot going on there. There's a lot we can learn from that about performing gender. I mean, it's this, you know, we're all trying to sort of feel and think our way through this, I think, moment we're in about gender identity and sexual orientation and all that. How does RuPaul help us?
Absolutely. So, you know, and I draw on the theorist Judith Butler, who talks about, you know, when you look at drag queens, you might think, oh, this is like an exaggeration of femininity. It might even be offensive to some. But actually, by looking at this kind of heightened presentation of femininity, we can learn more about how we ourselves are performing gender in kind of more muted ways in our everyday lives. So we're all kind of drag queens to an extent. RuPaul's drag queens are kind of just doing it. And again, in this more amplified kind of funhouse mirror kind of way. But every day, the vast majority of us are performing gender, and the vast majority of us are doing it in kind of normative ways, mm-hmm. ways that kind of reaffirm how we think about masculinity. Not everybody, obviously, but ways that reaffirm how we think about masculinity and femininity more broadly. Which again returns to that point about how reality TV, in some ways, while it may look really outrageous and wacky and zany, you know, really reaffirms for us some of our kind of more conservative cultural values.
But do you think it also helps move society forward when it comes to issues of transgender, LGBTQ people?
I think absolutely. I think, you know, reality TV has kind of always been on the vanguard of kind of queer representation. And yes, some of those representations are arguably harmful. But in terms of transgender representation, there's much more on reality TV than scripted television. There historically has been.
Why do you think that is?
I think that's true for a lot of things on reality TV, though. I think, one of the things about reality TV is that people don't take it seriously. So in some ways, it can kind of get away with doing things that scripted TV doesn't. So you see a lot of people of color on reality TV. You see a lot of queer people on reality TV. Whole shows of women on reality TV that you might not see in scripted media because, again, maybe people don't think anyone's paying attention or they just see it as kind of frivolous fun. And so in some ways, it has a lot more kind of leeway.
Because we don't take it seriously.
We don't take
right?
it as seriously.
Let me read a question from Yvonne, and then we'll play a scene from The Bachelor. Yvonne says, there's so much anger in these shows. People are always yelling. Does it also get people who watch it riled up? Why do people want to be in this agitated state?
I don't know if it gets people who watch riled up. There was one study that showed that young men, college men, watched it to learn more about how to handle relationships, which is slightly terrifying. So I don't know the sort of physiological reactions that people have to those shows. But I think one of the things is that people are kind of living vicariously through these archetypes. So for one thing, you know, because there are these archetypes, there's always someone you can sort of grab onto and say, I'm most like this person. I can put myself in Bethany's shoes. I am unabashedly a Bethany. Yes.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Oh, you got that.
Yeah,
okay.
I got it.
All right. So you can say I'm a Carol or I'm Bethany or I'm a Kristen. Or I don't think anyone identifies as a Ramona, but maybe. Ramona Singer, right, who threw that glass in that clip. But you can put yourself in that archetype's shoes. But they're also doing things that probably you would never do. And you probably would never throw a glass at anybody. But you might want to if someone annoys you. You might want to throw a glass at them. So you're kind of living vicariously through these adventures that your archetypes are having.
But we're also judging people, too. I mean,
at the same time, yes.
Yeah, at the same time. We might be identifying, but we're also criticizing and judging.
Absolutely. And it's a seeming paradox, right? Where on the one hand, we see this as a guilty pleasure. We are watching because we like to feel superior to – it's a train wreck, right? We're watching the train wreck to remind ourselves we are not of the train wreck. But at the same time, we're kind of grabbing onto pieces of the train wreck and saying, okay, this person reminds me of myself, so I'm going to take this journey with them.
Well, let's talk about The Bachelor, and let me play a scene. This is from the 2004 season, so it goes back some time. During the rose ceremony that ends each episode, The Bachelor gives a rose to the woman he's interested in, eliminating the others. But Bachelor Jesse Palmer accidentally calls out the wrong woman's name. Let's give it a listen.
Ladies, I'm sorry for taking that time. I'm very embarrassed to tell you this. Katie, I accidentally called out the wrong name, but I would like to extend to you the option of staying.
I'll stay and see how things go. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Why not?
This is now the final rose tonight. When you're ready.
Karen.
I thought you'd never ask.
Karen, I'm so sorry.
No, that's all right. I'm just happy.
Karen, will you please accept this role?
Absolutely, I will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, not exactly a fairy tale ending. But the woman who was wrongly identified then thanks him. She says thank you to him. What's going on there?
Oh, there's so much going on there. So much to unpack there.
Go for it.
I think, well... Okay, so for one thing, going back to the reason that we watch, right, again, there's this train wreck. So a scene like this enables us to say, I can't believe she would do that. She must have no self-respect. Thank goodness. Like, even though I might be messed up in my own ways, at least I'm not like that person over there who remained on The Bachelor through all of that. So it is this sort of weird tension to why we watch, because on the one hand, we're distancing ourselves from the people on the shows. You know, I'm not like that. But on the other hand, they're sort of resonating with us in some ways. Which is, I think, more broadly speaks to the reasons that we watch reality TV.
But I'm thinking about I don't watch The Bachelor, but in particular about the kind of message it sends about, you know, men and women and marriage and courtship and all of that. What do you make of that?
Again, it kind of harkens back to our more really conventional kind of traditional conservative, not necessarily politically conservative, although sometimes, yes, but it kind of values, right, about what constitutes a man, what constitutes a woman, this idea that marriage should be the ultimate goal, that it's only going to be a relationship of two people. It's a heterosexual relationship. It's not going to be more than two people. Rarely is it just one. Rarely do they not select a mate. This idea, again, marriage being the be-all, end-all. But again, you know, it does seem maybe a little archaic, right, with the long hair extensions and the, you know, the bedazzled evening gowns at like 10 o'clock in the morning. But I do think that it serves as a kind of pacifier for our cultural anxieties about how gender is changing and sexuality is changing, kind of to yank us back to this imagined period where everything kind of was neat and made sense.
Even though if someone picked the wrong
person. Even if they picked the wrong person, you have to stick to the script, right?
Well, here's an email from Irene. She says, the show is horribly, these shows are horribly demeaning to women. All the stereotypes, petty, snarky, jealous, empty, do-nothings, fighting with each other over nothing, I refuse to watch. And clearly, you know, you absolutely have a right to refuse to watch. But it does, and you have said this, play into these stereotypes that are not attractive when it comes to women, largely speaking.
It does play into these. Yeah, and of course, you don't have to like reality TV. I mean, there are shows that I can't stomach and I can't watch for a lot of these same reasons. But they're showing us something about ourselves, right? These stereotypes don't come from nowhere, right? They're showing us the fact that these stereotypes still kind of thrum through our culture, right? They're not gone. They're still there. And in some senses, even kind of more heightened. So, I mean, even if you turn on the TV and watch commercials, although I guess no one really watches commercials anymore, right? But even then, right, there are gender stereotypes there in front of our eyes. It's not just reality TV.
We're almost up at a break here, but what really bothers me is when I see children in these shows. Mm-hmm. I feel like that just crosses so many boundaries, so many lines where like a five-year-old, what is it, Toddlers and Tiaras. Yeah, it's like this five-year-old had no choice in whether they wanted to be exposed on TV or not. Let's pick up on that after this very short break. And again, talking with Danielle Linneman, and she is a professor at Lehigh University where she teaches sociology. She's written a couple of books and she's got a new one. It's called True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. And we've been playing clips from a variety of different reality TV programs. As always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, talking with our guest Danielle Linneman about reality TV. I mentioned children, and there, you know, there's Honey Boo, and there are, as you mentioned, Toddlers and Tiaras, and then there are these sort of more grown-up shows that do, you know, sometimes feature children, young children on them, and you know, I just feel, from my perspective, I feel like that just crosses a line that we shouldn't be watching seven-year-olds in tiaras.
I think certainly some of these shows feel really exploitative, like Toddlers and Tiaras, right? I mean, there are some shows featuring kids like Chopped Junior, where it's like a kids' cooking show, and it maybe feels a little bit less exploitative. I think kids are really interesting on reality TV because if you're looking for kind of real moments, they're often there with kids because it's often, if you have kids, you know, right? It's hard to kind of control. It's hard to script that, right? So you kind of see the smudges and the gloss when the kids come on the screen. But yeah, no, I do take your point that it does kind of see a show like Here Comes Honey Boo Boo or Toddlers and Tiaras, you know, they can't really consent really in a meaningful way to being portrayed. And it does seem a little different from a scripted show because they're being portrayed kind of as themselves.
Let me play another show, and this is from the first season, actually, of CBS's Survivor contestant Sue Hawk's memorable Rats and Snakes speech explaining why she won't vote for Kelly in the final tribal council ceremony. Let's give it a listen.
But Kelly, go back to a couple times Jeff said to you, what goes around comes around. It's here. You will not get my vote. My vote will go to Richard. And I hope that is the one vote that makes you lose the money. If it's not, so be it. I'll shake your hand and I'll go on from here. But if I ever pass you along in life again and you were laying there dying of thirst, I would not give you a drink of water. I would let the vultures take you and do whatever they want with you with no ill regrets.
You had mentioned earlier about things that we would never say to other people, but we would want to say. I think that's a good example of that, right?
Oh, it's such an interesting clip. I was actually on another show where they played that clip, and someone on Twitter got really angry at us for laughing at that clip because it's – but how can – it's so absurd, right? I don't think she really would let the vultures take her, Kelly, right? I think, you know, it's all amped up for the cameras. So I think it's hard not to laugh because it is just a little bit absurd.
Right. And here we are playing it because it has, I mean, this is what, a season that goes back, you know, a number of years.
Oh,
right?
And that was really, you know, that first season of Survivor really was the juggernaut that really showed, you know, how lucrative reality TV could be. I talked to a lot of people who know exactly they were where they were sitting when Richard Hatch won that first season. Everybody was watching it. Millions of people were watching it. So, it's a really kind of iconic scene, but also an iconic season of the show because that's people look at Real World and say, you know, that kind of started everything when it came to reality TV, and it did. But Survivor really helped to move that train along.
And obviously very tribal, right? So it sort of plays into all that group dynamic.
Group dynamics, yes, absolutely.
Here's a tweet from Morrissey. Some of the reality shows seem insensitive or shallow. My daughter and I really like the show Queer Eye. It's very positive. They really try to change people's lives physically and emotionally. And it gets a great template on how a reality show can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you know, reality TV really has been kind of the vanguard of queer representation, and you know, queer—not even the current iteration of Queer Eye, but going back to the original,
which was a terrific show,
Queer Eye, right? And so, and introduced kind of like a wide swath of Americans who had like never met a person who openly identified as gay. So I think it's. We really can't ignore. Yes, we often focus on the sort of negative aspects and the negative things that they promulgate about our culture, but we can't ignore the positive as well.
Let me read a comment and then we'll play a Kim Kardashian clip.
Good.
And this is an email from Thomas. Any comments on the cooking show competitions, reality TV made with a veneer of class, although he goes on to say, except for Gordon Ramsay's stuff. But, you know, there's a whole genre of cooking shows.
Oh, yeah. And Gordon Ramsay, I could talk about Gordon Ramsay for an hour and what that says about masculinity and how we accept meanness when it comes from white men. Or I guess I only needed like a few seconds to talk about that.
Yeah, there you go.
But the cooking show is really interesting because I talk to many people who say they don't watch reality TV. And then it comes out that they do watch shows like these cooking shows. So people kind of have this hierarchy in their minds when it comes. There's the really guilty pleasure stuff, which when they say they don't watch reality TV, they mean like, I don't watch Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. I don't watch the Kardashians, but they're still watching something that falls under the umbrella of reality TV. Maybe they just don't know it.
Oh, interesting. Well, speaking of the Kardashians, let me play. This is Kim Kardashian, and she gets upset when her $75,000 diamond earring falls out after being tossed in the ocean around Bora Bora. Apparently her sister later does find the $75,000 diamond earring, and she's referring to Chris, which is, we think, either her mother or some apparent boyfriend at the time.
Well, she was married to Chris for like 5 minutes. Yeah.
Okay, for about 5 minutes. Let's give it a listen.
Wait. My earring's gone!
Are you s***?
Oh my God, I'm gonna cry. I have an earring.
Hold on.
Seriously. It's not funny.
Are you serious?
Literally, that's $75,000.
Hold on, we'll find it, baby.
We're not gonna find it in the ocean.
Chris, he's so playful. He throws me in the water. I land on the side of my head, and I feel my earring is gone. I'm pretty upset. So I just want to run away, because Chris has never seen me cry before, and I'm kind of embarrassed.
Oh, what happened?
So what's
that
is her husband, Chris.
Yes.
That is her husband, Chris.
Her former husband, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the deal with the Kardashians?
What is the deal? You'd think she'd have those insured. I don't know.
Apparently she was married to Chris Humphreys. So Chris Humphreys, yeah.
That was her husband for about 5 minutes. What is the deal with the Kardashians? So, yeah, there's so much to say about the Kardashians. You know, there's one study that showed that people who watch shows like the Kardashians are more materialistic. Is that because the show's making them more materialistic, or because more materialistic people tend to gravitate toward those shows? I don't know. But obviously there's kind of a rampant materialism in keeping up with the Kardashians. But, you know, going back to why I enjoy these shows, sure. I mean, that's, you know, just kind of, if that's the biggest conflict, that you lost your earring, if there's something to be said. At one point, that's absurd, but also there's something kind of relaxing about that, that it's not about violence. It's not about something that's really high stakes. It's just like, okay, this, you know, millionaire or maybe millionaire at that point lost one of her earrings. There's something relaxing about watching that, at least to me.
Even though it was worth apparently $75,000.
I know, but she probably was insured, I would assume. Okay, I'm not crying too many tears about it.
Here's a comment from Jen. People absolutely hate the Kardashians and go out of their way to comment on it. Challenge yourself. If they were all successful men, would you have this deep hatred? Our cultural bashing of the Kardashians reveals our own misogyny. That's an interesting comment from Jen.
I think so.
And sticking up for the Kardashians.
Yeah, you know, and I often say, you know, what people ask, you know, why is reality TV still a guilty pleasure? You know, a majority of us are watching it, studies show. Why do people still think, why does it still have this kind of stink to it? And I think part of that, not everything, but part of that is that it's often associated with women and femininity on the shows, but also the viewers, right? And we love to devalue cultural products that are related to women and femininity, right? Like chick lit and chick flits. What flicks? Why not just movies, right? Or books. And so I absolutely think gender is playing a role. People are also up in arms about the fact that they're famous for being famous. They feel like they haven't earned their fame. But there's always been people who are famous for being famous, right? Royalty, right? They didn't do anything to earn their fame. They're just famous for being part of a family, as are the Kardashians.
And that is our guest, Danielle Linneman. We're talking about reality TV and her new book, True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, I don't know if we saved the best for last, but here is a scene from season 4 of The Apprentice, of course, hosted by host Donald Trump.
Josh, I think you were a very, very ineffective leader. Your decision making was absolutely terrible. James, you built a batting cage. You took up all this space. Mark, this is a sales task. You didn't sell a single thing. And again, in this boardroom, we've never had a team lose so badly. You're all fired. All four are fired.
Now, at that time in Trump's career, his business empire was really imploding. And so The Apprentice, you know, was the thing that kind of catapulted him into success, you know, within the sort of realm of television and reality shows. And then, you know, as you say, if you look at some of the tropes that he used to run for the White House, you can see reality TV writ large.
Yeah, I mean, he's a master of that form, right? Using these kind of tropes and conventions of reality TV, right? The cliffhanger. Oh, I've picked a new Supreme Court justice nominee. I'll tell you at prime time. Everybody show up. Oh, never mind. I'll do it tomorrow, right? Always kind of keeping you hanging, using broad archetypes, as we've talked about, right? The sort of nasty woman, the bad hombre, to kind of stir people's anxieties up. So, yeah, I mean, I think being on reality TV really I mean, we don't really know. Apprentice, right? If he hadn't been in The Apprentice, would he still have ended up in the White House? I think there's reason to believe that it did kind of catalyze it. I actually was talking to someone who said that she was campaigning for Hillary in the 2016 election, and she was going door to door in Pennsylvania, and people said, no, I'm voting for Trump. I saw him on The Apprentice. I liked him. So there is that anecdotal evidence that people, you know, he's behind a desk, he's in a power suit, he's in a position of unambiguous power, he's always right on that show, right? So it was a particular presence that he was portraying that people really gravitated to. And I think it's reasonable to believe that that kind of accelerated his path to the White House.
And can we say he turned the presidency into a reality show?
I mean, so, you know, Bill Clinton played a saxophone on a reality show, and there was Richard Nixon on Laugh-In. So there always was kind of that entertainment aspect. Oh, Ronald Reagan, of course, right? There's always an entertainment aspect to reality TV, but he, you know, turned that dial up to 11. Again, really kind of masterfully playing with this form.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from James, who sent this up early in the show. I don't buy this pseudo-intellectual argument to justify people's addiction to reality TV. Reality TV served us up Donald Trump on a silver platter, which is just, you know, I don't know if you're saying it was a silver platter, but I think it helps at least shed a little bit of light about how you can use celebrity and attention, and in his case, reality TV, to get the spotlight and then to use it to run for the White House.
Yeah, I want to be clear that I'm sort of not justifying anybody's addiction to reality. As I said, you know, I'm a fan, but there's certain shows that I absolutely cannot watch. And The Apprentice is one of them. Personally, Cops is another. So it's not the aim of the book is not to sort of justify anyone's attachment to reality TV. But I think it's a mistake to kind of just see it as a frivolous kind of sideshow when, as you know, as this person even points out, right, it served us Donald Trump, right? It is the main event in many ways, and it's important to pay attention to it and take it seriously. And you don't have to like it, but it's important to kind of look at it as an important cultural object.
Here's an email from Matt. This reminds me of when people talk about beer. Sure, you can create a culture around it, but the point is to feel the effects of drinking like being a social lubricant. I'm not saying that these shows can't offer something more. It just seems like at a base level, they're appealing to pleasure principle type things. I wonder if that's a good thing. And we were talking about this earlier about whether is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? And I get the feeling it's from you. It's probably a combination of both, right?
Well, is it a good
thing?
Or it
is just what it is.
For broader, I mean, it is what it is. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. It's, you know, it sort of promulgates the worst aspects of our society in some ways. It does negative things to us as viewers in some ways, but it also does positive things to us as viewers, and it introduces us to areas of kind of nooks and crannies of society that we never would experience otherwise. But also, you know, I kind of reject this premise that we can't just do things for pleasure, right? Sometimes, you know, people often say, well, where's the intellectual value in reality TV? I do think there is intellectual value, but even if you don't, we can still consume things for pleasure. So I think we need to think about why we're so averse to just saying, okay, this is just something that is purely pleasurable, and we like let that wash over us, and that's the purpose.
Because we don't deserve it, or we should be a more serious person, or
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with capitalism and the fact that, you know, we're not supposed to have leisure. We're always supposed to be productive. We're always supposed to be working, right? We're not supposed to just do anything purely for pleasure, especially if we're women or it involves women.
Well, I have confessed that I have watched The Real Housewives, and I have also found over time that they're just really boring. And maybe because they're so predictable, or something happened in the last couple of years that just, I don't care anymore.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say that also when there's so much kind of going on in the world that is so weighty, it's really hard to look. And there's so much social inequality. It's really hard to look at people who ostensibly sort of have a lot and are behaving frivolously with it. So I see that.
Yeah. Tweet from Rebecca. I started clapping when Marty Moss Cohen introduced my favorite scene of all time, Kim K losing her earring. I knew it was coming even before it was played. I mean, I do think what's interesting for people who watch it is it's that water cooler thing. I mean, even if people aren't at work, It's something you can share. You can talk about what happened with Kim Kardashian and her earring.
Right. So again, it is this really interesting paradox where it's this guilty pleasure. We're not supposed to admit that we watch it. But at the same time, it serves this kind of communal function where it draws us together. And again, kind of rejecting the people who are on the screen. At least I'm not like Kim Kardashian. It was so crazy when she did that thing with her earring. Right. And so it draws you closer to the other people who are viewing these shows.
Do you have a favorite reality show? I mean, one that you just you feel like you can return to and it gives you what you're looking for?
Oh, that's such a good... I mean, there's so many. But probably RuPaul's Drag Race is my favorite of all times. They're just... there's so many interesting things happening around kind of gender. And I feel like I learned so much from that show. Everything I know about drag, I learned from RuPaul's Drag Race. So I think it just is an example of the great kind of teaching potential. Not every show has teaching potential. I don't know what we learned from the Kardashians. But reality, I think RuPaul's Drag Race has sort of taught me a lot about that kind of subculture. And I do appreciate that.
Well, good place to end our discussion. Danielle Linneman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. And she is Associate Professor of Sociology at Lehigh University. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.